This is the second hour with David Matheson. We're talking about his book, The Undying Stars. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the member section. We're glad to have you along for the rest of the discussion here. Very interesting. We're talking about the deal struck between the Roman generals and Josephus, the treasure, the creation of religion through the vehicle of Mithraism, how that arose. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the nature of the deal. And this might be questions that are very difficult to get closer to, I guess, but the motivation here and trying to understand that you talked about of trying to take over and start running the Roman Empire in a different direction. I mean, we're talking about a collaboration here, which is leading to some kind of, you know, mutiny, for the lack of a better term, and taking things in a completely different direction. What do you think the nature of this deal was? What was going through the minds of these people who were striking the deal? Was there, because surely there has to be antagonism on the part of someone like Josephus from the Roman general's point of view, because he's just murdered this entire people, and all of a sudden they're like, you know, buddy buddies. It's kind of difficult to believe that as well, right?
Right. Well, that's a good question. I think the motivation on Josephus's side originally, when he was down in the cistern, you know, the water supply for this fortress. They were standing kind of waist deep in water with the last defenders when they decided to draw lots and kill each other. I think he wanted to stay alive primarily at first. But I mean, obviously your question has more to it than that. But and Vespasian wanted the empire, so he wanted that treasure. And also one of his contemporary biographers from the Roman times mentioned he had he had all these great virtues, but he really was a guy who cared about money a lot. But anyway, yeah. And Barbiero cites that as, hey, this could be additional evidence that supports this theory. But so, yeah, why would he treat this, you know, this former enemy so grandiosely that he even put him up in his own villa? Well, I think because he realized that he owed the fact that he was the emperor to that treasure, that he was able to pay off his troops to continue to stay with him, and they marched into Egypt next, and basically they took over, and Vespasian took over as the emperor right after that. So, but.
Because let me ask you this. I mean, Josephus, sure. Well, he was a strategist as well. These are clever people here. And I just can't help to think as well that there are ulterior motives behind the scenes. I guess what I'm saying is, if the Roman general was he really that naive to trust Josephus full on like this as well, do you think? I mean, there had to have been some kind of fear of backstabbing and everything else in this situation, right?
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Henrik. And maybe, you know, everyone's got to weigh the evidence for themselves. But I would say that the Romans really did have a pattern of making, you know, they didn't just conquer countries or peoples and turn them into abject slaves like some of the, previous empires that you learn about in history did, where it's like, okay, now you're going to all be, basically chained to a farm implement and be working in the fields for the rest of your life. They right. were able to, and they did this all the way through, all the way through France and other places. They would conquer and beat the armies, and then they would somehow co-opt those guys into the empire, where the people who had been leading before were still leading things later, but they were now under Rome and they were giving tribute to Rome. And when Rome said do this, they would do that. And it's kind of like, you can see this pattern even in the modern era, where a people is subdued and maybe the chiefs or the warriors or the families fought against the invaders. But there's some turncoats or there's some people who were on the outs, and the invaders say, hey, you want to be in charge? You sure weren't treated very well before, but under our system, you can be the king. And I think that's kind of the pattern that the Romans took, and they were very successful. That's how they put together this big empire and held it together for so long. But your original question was also, you know, how was Vespasian, was he enabling this this takeover of the Roman Empire? Why would he do that? No, this took a long time. This took 300 years. This goes all the way up to Constantine proclaiming Christianity. So we haven't brought in the angle of Christianity yet, but under the thesis of Flavio Barbiero, so Christianity and Mithraism are often in the conventional histories portrayed as rival religions. You know,
right?
Mithraism. The reason it didn't really work out was because Christianity was more open. It let women in, and Mithraism was exclusive to men. And so it kind of, it never got the popular appeal. It did catch on in the army for a while, but it, you know, eventually died out. That's the conventional story. But they were rivals. But Barbiero's thesis is no. Mithraism was the secret, hidden. That was the nerve center. That was the brains of their campaign to take over the Roman Empire. But they're patient. They're going to do it over hundreds of years. Josephus isn't going to be alive anymore. You know, he died around AD 100. Yep. Constantine wasn't proclaimed emperor until 306 by his troops, and he didn't really secure the reins of power completely until AD 324. So this is 224 years after Josephus dies. But Mithraism was the nerve center. That was the brain cell. That was the secret organization. But Christianity was, they were going to use that as the front. That was the popular vehicle. That's going to be open to everybody. Pagans, you know, Italian descent, doesn't matter. You don't have to be from one of these exclusive families to make it to the top like you do in Mithraism, according to the Barbiero theory. So Christianity is going to be the more open expression. Why? Because that's the public target. Look, taking over the Roman Empire is not going to be easy, and you're not going to do it by force. And the senators and the families that have a lot of money and have a lot of power and have all, you know, they've got the whole system working in their advantage, and they've got the control of the pagan temples, and they get a lot of money because of it. They're not going to just say, oh, you know, they're going to fight back. But the genius of this plan was, we're going to give them a target to fight against. That'll be Christianity. And they never quite figured out that the shots were being called from within these little cells of Mithraism. It was this underground network and they knew exactly what they wanted to go after. First the Praetorian Guard, then the Roman army, then the centers of commerce, then the bureaucratic mechanisms of the governing bodies of the empire. And that's what they did. And it took them a long time.
Was kept in the Flavian family primarily. I mean, because again, I'm always really fascinated how the long-term, you know, goals can be set up and then achieved over, multi-generational, or even if there's new people brought into it. But I guess what you're describing is the nature of a secret society really underneath that are let into what the agenda is, and they're executing it, I guess, right?
That's exactly right. And that's how they pass it on from one generation to the next, is when when you're a promising young man of 16, you get to go to your first Mithraic meeting or whatever, because you're from one of these families. And if you, and they kind of watch you at the lower levels. And if you turn out to be, oh, this guy's really just a party guy, he's not really, doesn't show much promise or whatever, we'll leave him at the lower levels, and he probably doesn't really care to get to the higher levels anyway, because he just wants to drive the equivalent of a Porsche or whatever. But
but by the way, have you ever heard about the Despicini? Does that play into this as well?
I have not.
Okay, I think
that's interesting.
They're probably called the brother of Jesus, I think, as well, or the brothers of Jesus, but the Despicini is another kind of a royal family that allegedly some even have claimed to, that there were actually a lineage of Jesus, I guess. But nonetheless, it seems to be another kind of infrastructure behind the scenes in a way. But that's something for another time then.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because, you know, I believe that the lineage of Jesus question is, I think that that's a literal interpretation. I think that, you know, the Jesus incarnating is a literal explanation of what these ancient scriptures are talking about. he's incarnating in humanity in each one of us. You know, that's the esoteric reading of that. So I don't think there was a literal Jesus or a literal 12 disciples, but that doesn't mean that I don't think that the things that it's talking about are true. Just like I don't think that there was a literal Zeus, but it doesn't mean that I don't think that what those ancient myths are talking about are not conveying truth. So That's an interesting question. But as if you read through Barbiero's book, which he really goes into the history of Europe, so the original question was about the family lines. Josephus says, "Hey, I'm from the first priestly family. I'm from the most prestigious of the priestly families." But there were these priestly families who had been running the temple system before the Romans came and took over Judea and burned down the temple, or destroyed the temple for hundreds of years, going all the way back perhaps to the Babylonian captivity, if that indeed was a literal event. I'm not convinced necessarily that it may also have some allegorical stuff that was woven into it, but that's described in the Old Testament. But Flavio Barbiero goes into that in his book, and he says, look, these priestly lines, when Josephus was telling Titus, okay, don't kill that guy, he can bring his family, don't kill that guy, he was picking the heads of the priestly lines, and they came back to Rome. So it wasn't just one family, but they were all, you know, cousins, or they were all part of these lines that continued on down and eventually became all the kings and queens of Europe, because what happened in the nobility, because what happened was after this long period of time of taking over the Roman Empire and eventually maneuvering their way to getting Constantine, who was from this family line, at least there's some circumstantial evidence to argue that. And it's passed down through the mother, by the way. After that, they eventually, not too long after Constantine, said, you know what, we're going to discard this Roman emperor idea, and we're going to run things through the church. In fact, they were trying to take over the Roman Empire, and the senators and the old families were fighting back. And when they finally declared Christianity, Constantine wasn't the first emperor to proclaim himself to be Christian. Julius Philippus, or sometimes called Philip the Arab, AD 244, he declared himself to be a Christian. He was the first Christian emperor before Constantine. But this Mithraism, the cult of Sol Invictus, was basically calling the shots of who's going to be emperor. And in order to try and, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but this is kind of important for the theory. In order to try and get out from under the reign of terror that the Mithra organization had over the emperor, because if you were the emperor, if they put you in as the emperor and you started going in a direction they didn't like, you'd be assassinated.
Right.
And it would happen 2 weeks after you became the emperor in some cases.
Yeah. We've seen that with the popes in modern times, even 33 days in office, you know.
so there was an emperor before Constantine who, named Diocletian, who said, I'm going to come up with a method to get out from under this Sol Invictus. I don't want them calling the shots, and I don't want them killing me if I don't do what they say. So I'm going to break the emperorship into a tetrarchy. I'm going to share it. And he picked another guy to be his co-emperor. And he said, each of us are going to pick a Caesar. And so we're going to basically rule among four of us. And he picked them each from a different region, because what Sol Invictus would do is if you were the emperor and they didn't like you, they'd go to another region and say, okay, this promising general right here, let's have him go replace the emperor. But by dividing up the empire into these four pieces, Diocletian really stumped them for a while. And there was this big bloody year of five emperors where everyone was vying for the imperial throne after Diocletian. And that's when they brought in Constantine, and they said, listen, we're going to do something different. We have to do something different here. We're going to proclaim Christianity to be the religion of the empire, even though it was really a minority at this point of Romans were Christians. It was still a very tiny, the conventional narrative on this is completely different from what Barbiero thinks actually happened. Constantine, you're going to declare that you're a Christian. Then you're going to declare that the Roman Empire is Christian. And then we're going to eventually shut down everything else, and we're going to rule through that. And eventually, we're even going to shut down the throne of the emperor, because that's too much of a pain. All it does is it causes all these battles and armies marching across the empire to try and take over the emperor. We're going to get rid of that, and we're just going to run things through the church. And that's what they did in the Middle Ages. The so-called fall of the Roman Empire, they threw it away like a husk that they didn't need anymore. It's like the Roman Empire ate this, you know, parasite when they took over the temple in Jerusalem, and it ate them from the inside, and then it spit out the empty skin said, "We're done. Jeez. We're done with the Roman Empire. Now we've got Europe all tied up, and they're basically controlled by the church, and all the nobles were descended from these families."
Well, see, and that kind of harkens back to my initial point a little bit. I'm not trying to put everything plans such grandiose into the hands of Josephus or anything like that, but I guess that's what I'm saying here. If the tendency of the battle was so intense and there was about the brink of extinction, the fact that he was, you know, lured in by the enemy in that regard, and then the enemy, you know, consumes them from the inside, that's just remarkable, you know, how that happened.
You might say that's just really hard to swallow, or that's
that
really
too,
hard to
yeah,
believe.
That too. Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, it is it is really different from anything that we've been taught, but you know, in history, but you know, Flavio Barbiero says, well, here, this theory has a few things going for it. First of all the there's a lot of historical evidence that he musters, but second of all, these priestly families, they knew how to run a religion. And there's a lot of parallels between the religion that they were running in Judea before it was taken over by the Romans and what they later established, the paying of the tithes to the temple and the succession through the line of the mother, and the use of certain symbols and heraldry that tie right back to ancient Judea, like the lion. I mean, you know, we spelled out my last name at the end of the show, Mathisen. That's the Norwegian spelling. What do the Norwegians have on their heraldic, you know, symbols?
They all have a lion. Right.
Now crazy. You're up in Scandinavia. How many lions do you guys have up there?
None.
Well,
some at the zoo, maybe. Some at the zoo.
Yeah, right. So why did all these royal families around Europe, and Flavio Barbiero talks about this, in the 11th century, they all of a sudden just break out all these heraldic devices, and they use things like a lion, a fleur-de-lis, a tower, you know, palm tree. All these things go right back to the Old Testament, right back to the tribes of Judah, right back to the 12 tribes of Israel, you know, which are the celestial, you know, the 12 tribes of Israel are the zodiac signs. Okay, we could talk right about the implications of that. That's not, the Israelites are not descended from the stars, right? So who were they? But
so let me
but
ask
all
you this.
These devices, yeah. So yeah. So that's an important piece of evidence. But so, but your question is kind of just real quick.
I'll
say it in a sentence. You know, this is a little bit hard to swallow, unless there's something. There's something more to this esoteric tradition. You know, it's not just natural. Maybe these guys had access to, maybe these guys knew how to go across the shamanic boundary and find out, you know, they were able to put together a pretty amazing strategy. I don't know how, you know, I'm not dogmatic about it. And at the end of the book, I say, you know, maybe there's more at work here than meets the eye, because this is a pretty amazing scenario, but there's some pretty substantial evidence that this is just what happened. And so maybe there's more to this ancient knowledge that they're keeping from everybody else than meets the eye. Like I said, it's kind of like if you know Kung Fu, even if you just know a few moves, you can go into a bar fight, a bar over and over, and use the same move in all these different bars and just keep winning. And they pass down their secret moves and they used them and they've been keeping them from everybody else. And it worked. So anyway, you know, everyone has to weigh the evidence for themselves. But like I said, I divided my book up into, here's the ancient system. Here's what it might mean. Here might be the implications of this ancient system. What's it trying to teach? And here's what happened to it. something happened to it.
Yeah.
And there's some pretty good evidence that this is what happened to it, because this is when the Gnostics were all suppressed. The Christianity was there before these guys came along, but the esoteric interpretations were all suppressed, and the esoteric texts were all destroyed, except for the Nag Hammadi text. Somebody buried some. That's another piece of evidence that, you know, the esoteric was suppressed by the literalists. And anyway, I'll let you ask some questions.
No, it's good. I wanted to ask you a bit. I mean, I've heard about the 12, tribes of Israel, the tie-in, of course, with, if they're lost or not, whatever, you know, but just as you say, in terms of the of heraldry and everything, that's not necessarily a brand, you know, new thing to me, but there are a number of things there which I wanted to bring up. And one of them, of course, you have, for example, the British Israelite kind of, you know, movement, that there is a, you know, Judaic origin, just as you say, to some of the royal houses that this. But my question to you is a little bit more in terms of what the origin point of this, or where, how it harkens back. I guess I'm interested in trying to understand if this is a hybrid that arose at the time of this joint venture that we kind of have been talking about here. Because to me, then, it doesn't seem that it's necessarily, let's say, ethnic. It's an ideology, rather. It's a belief system and the creation of a kind of a myth to a certain extent. And it doesn't mean that it's not have a basis in, as you say, reality and communicating a message. But this kind of idea that, you know, yeah, we are British Israelites, and we are, you know, it's, we descend from, you know, Jesus or whatever. It kind of ties in with the Despicini a little bit as well. We own the earth because we're descendant of the Savior, kind of thing. It ties into some of those ideas as well. But how would you describe that? Are they joined by an ideology, let's say, of conquest? Is that the agenda, or is there something else behind there?
Yeah, great, great question. So I do not believe that anyone is descended from literal 12 tribes, because I believe that the 12 tribes is an esoteric teaching. Look, on that zodiac wheel, we started off at the summit of the summer solstice, and we go down to the pit of the winter solstice, which, by the way, that means this is not a literal hell that they're talking about. The lower half of the zodiac is metaphorized as hell in all these different ancient traditions, but the threat of hell is used as a, hey, you better obey or you might go to hell. It's a form of mind control. But on its way down there, there's a crossing point on the way down, the equinox, and a crossing point on the way up. And at the crossing point at the way up, if, you know, when Abraham is told, go sacrifice your son, these crossing points are always points of sacrifice. And on the way up the hill, Abraham, he's going up a hill. He's supposed to kill his son. He's got him tied up, and a ram shows up and saves the son Isaac from being sacrificed. Well, what is at that crossing point on the way up the zodiac but the sign of Aries? So that whole story, Isaac, the ram, Abraham going up the hill, it's all esoteric. It's all celestial. And going down the wheel, as we, now we're heading down towards the pit of the winter solstice. There's another crossing point right there at Virgo, in between Virgo and Libra. And when the Greeks are going down to Troy in the Iliad, or in the myths of the Trojan War, sure enough, there's a sacrifice demanded at the crossing. Before we cross the ocean to get over to Troy, we got to sacrifice, this time a daughter, Iphigenia, the daughter of one of the kings of the Greeks, Agamemnon, and his wife Clytemnestra. They have a daughter, Iphigenia. She's going to be sacrificed. But at the last moment, in some myths she is sacrificed, but at the last moment a stag shows up and they sacrifice that instead. And sure enough, we've got a maiden being sacrificed. So that's Virgo right there at that crossing point. And right underneath Virgo, there's this constellation Centaurus, the centaur. And I show it in the book. And in fact, it's in the three chapters you can see online on my website, on the blog. If you just remove one of the connecting lines on Centaurus, instead of being a man, with arms and the torso of a man and the body of a horse, it looks like a stag, and the torso in the centaur becomes the head of the the stag. So there's lots of myths where there's a stag right at that crossing point. Even in North America, there's American, Native American, Indian traditions where there's a stag in the crossing point. But anyway, so I don't think those 12 tribes of Israel are Aries and Taurus and Gemini. Leading them up out of the land of bondage means leading them up out of the lower half of the zodiac and up into the promised land up there by the summer solstice where the streets are paved with gold in the New Testament metaphor. But the land of milk and honey in the Old Testament metaphor of paradise, I just published a blog post called A Land Flowing with Milk and Honey. You know, that if you know this system of celestial metaphor, you would say, well, let's see, milk and honey, where would that be on the wheel? Well, that would be up at the summer solstice. Who's up there? Oh, Gemini and Cancer. Well, sure enough, Cancer, as we've already said, has the beehive cluster. There's your honey. And Gemini, one end of the Milky Way is right, goes right through Gemini. That's the land flowing with milk and honey. So if you go through the blessings of the 12 tribes in the Old Testament, you know, every single one of those tribes is mentioned with a celestial metaphor. Judah, you are like a lion's whelp. Okay, well, that's, you know, that's Leo. So I don't believe that there's any, you know, the kings aren't descended from a literal Jesus or
sure.
a literal tribe.
No, I don't believe that either. I guess I was asking if they believe it in that regard, or if that's kind of a, because you have the creation of something new there. I mean, I find it's just fascinating, you know, with the European history at that time. I mean, it takes a long time for this to traverse further up north. We had that famous battle at Teutoburg in northern Germany, where the Germanic tribes managed to actually keep out the Roman Empire from any further incursion further up. And it's not until many hundred years later, actually, where more of the kings are being converted by threat, you know, after all these battles taking place after a couple of hundred years. It takes a long time there, but this system spreads in a very interesting way, and the way it's done, you know. So I'm just trying to get a little closer to what they believed, I guess, to a certain extent, of even the willingness of converting, you know. And these are very difficult questions to get to, of course. I mean, I think no one of us can really know really what the reasons were. There were political reasons, we know that much. It was a reasons of trying to avoid war at a certain point, to realize that there's just too much of a powerful force. But it seems to have been a really strong viral, for the lack of a better term, agenda that was going on. A lot of people were sucked into it, and I've always been, why did they do this, to give up their own traditions and to do all these things? You know, they have to be, I don't know, it's strange to me.
That's a great question. It's a huge question of history. But I'll tell you, one of the things that Josephus mentions was given to him as a privilege by Vespasian was tax-free on his lands. Okay, that's really interesting, because that's the pattern. These noble families, so after, you know, the Roman Empire starts to come apart in the 400s, and I think they said, look, let's move the capital out of Rome. Let's get the emperor away from the center of our church. Let's get the emperor away, because he's a problem. You know, there's a potential. So let's just run things out of Rome. And then let's split the empire. And then when they did that, they knew that the empire, or at least it was inevitable that the thing is going to come apart. But the noble families that by now they've got, look, once you've got the empire, once you've got the emperor, which they did, they could say they've got access to a lot of money, and they got access to who's going to be tax-free and who's not. And we're going to give the lands to the people in France and in all these different regions, to our people from our families and from our connections, and to barbarians, so-called, who are providing the muscle. A lot of the armies of the empire were filled by the, you know, the barbarians.
Oh yeah, definitely.
The Romans didn't want to do it anymore. They're exactly. Like, hey, I'm drinking wine here. I don't want to go. I don't want to go out to the frontiers. Yeah. So the barbarian chiefs or generals would marry one of the daughters and once they're in that line, then their sons can be. Hey, they could be an emperor, or they could become a priest. See, to be a priest in the Christian system, or to become a pope someday, you had to be from one of these lines. So if you managed to get married to one of the daughters from these lines, then your kids had a chance to make it into that system.
Yeah.
But so Britain is a very interesting case because it's pretty clear from Barbiero's book that that was a real stronghold of these priestly families. When the legions retreated in the 400s, it was left in the priestly families that had been there, they controlled it. But the Anglo-Saxons came in to Britain and drove a lot of them out, and they retreated down to Normandy, down what today we call Normandy, down to France. But they bided their time, and they said, that's our island, we're getting it back. And they did under William the Conqueror, who came from these priestly lines. And Charlemagne, you know, you're referring to these guys converting underneath the, you know, at the point of a sword. Charlemagne did that all across Europe.
Yeah.
His grandfather was a guy named Charles Martel. Charles Martel lived from 688 AD. So this isn't that long after the fall of the Roman Empire, or the dissolving, or the throwing away of the husk of the Roman Empire by these families. Charles Martel lived from 688 to 741. Charlemagne was from 742 to 814. In between there was Pepin the Short, was the son of Charles Martel. But Martel, what does that mean? That means the hammer. Charlemagne's grandfather was called Charles the Hammer. And it just so happens that in the time of the Judean fighting against the Roman Empire, way back, you know, even before Josephus, there was a leader called Judas Maccabeus the Hammer. He's the Hammer. He was a great warrior, and he was called the Hammer. And there's all these kings who take on the name of the Hammer, Charles Martel being the most prominent one because he's the grandfather of Charlemagne. Why did he take on the name of the Hammer? They're saying, look, we're part of this. This is our family line going all the way back. So once Charlemagne had all of Europe, he said, look, you're going to be the Baron of, I don't know, Swabia or whatever. Well, but I don't speak German. I don't care. Go out there. You're going to have lands. They're not going to be taxed. Everyone else's will be taxed. You're going to have tons of money. You'll learn to speak German. You'll be in charge. And that's what they did. They put their people all over Europe once they got it taken over. And they went back into England in between getting driven out of England by the Anglo-Saxons, or they also hid out in Wales. Wales was never completely taken over by the Anglo-Saxons, and Cornwall, a few isolated pockets. But the way they went in first was with Christianity. They would send in the priests and the bishops, you know, going around and converting people to Christianity. And the women who, you know, they would marry, the chieftains would marry the women, and the women would be a strong argument towards, hey, you got to come over to Christianity. And, okay, that's fine. And then eventually when William the Conqueror came back in, yeah, he defeated the forces that were arrayed against him, but then he basically went through the realm showing his flag and saying, hey, I'm back, we're back. And he took it over, not as if he was conquering it, but that he was coming back to something. It was like, you know, coming back to something that belonged to him originally. He's like, hey, the people didn't resist him. They said, oh, you know, you guys are back.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's... We don't want to get too far into the weeds.
No, it's interesting though. I like this piece of this particular time, you know, because there's you know, the Norman conquest of England there. You know, it's just fascinating. And then of course you have the Norman connection, the Normandy, which is a Viking connection there to Rollo and everything.
Yeah,
who set that up in Normandy?
William the Conqueror is descended from Rollo, but yeah. See, there's some marriage of specific, you know, Normandy located women that, you know, William the Conqueror got his access to the priestly lines through the line of his mother.
Right.
And I'll say another, and so this is kind of, you know, if this is correct, then some of those families are still probably in charge. I mean, once you've got access to that kind of money and lands, they stay in the family. And here's another piece of evidence, and it's a whole nother direction to talk about, but there is some evidence that when the original suppression of the Gnostic Christians and the ancient wisdom and the mystery traditions by the literalists was taking place, there were people who fled from that to the Americas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the Americas were known to the ancients. Diodorus Siculus, who was a historian, he wrote 40 volumes. He describes the continents of North and South America in his fifth book of his 40-volume history very extensively. And I think a lot of those ancient, the people who were fleeing this literalist takeover, once the literalists, you know, got enough control to where they could say, look, you can't have those interpretations anymore, or we'll kill you if you're in possession of these texts and you don't give them to us to burn, we'll kill you. Constantine said that to, you know, there was the Arius, the heresy of Arius, the Arian heresy, A-R-I-U-S. And you can go on Wikipedia and look up the Arian heresy and see Constantine's edict that said, everyone who has these texts, you give them up to us and we'll burn them. And if we find that you've hidden one of these texts, you'll be killed. Well, that's what they were doing with the Gnostic interpretations. That's why that interpretation was suppressed. And there were some who said, let's get out of here. And they came to the Americas and they interacted with the people who were already there. And there's tons of artifacts that suggest that. And there's tons of evidence that suggests that. And then when the literalists finally had control of Europe, they had enough power and technology, and hey, we can cross the ocean again, and we can put soldiers on ships, and we can put horses on ships. Let's go over there and let's go get some revenge.
Yeah, because I mean, exactly. Think about it. How many different waves of excursions there have been over there? Speculations of course, the 9th Roman Legion, but you have before that, you had the Viking expeditions of Leif Erikson. You had rumors of Clovis people, Solotrians. There is just an endless string of recognition that there was something beyond the sea, you know, towards the west. And I've been thinking about that too, how many actually went over there and how many, what the reasonings were. I mean, there's even some of the Templar speculations as well, right? And they've actually preserved some of the knowledge and they took that with them over to the American continent. And that's one of the reasons why some of the Catholic forces went over there to take them over later.
Absolutely. You bring up a really good point. And the Templars, I mean, that brings up the whole question of the Crusades. You know, all these noble families, why did they want to go back and conquer Jerusalem, right? Because that's where the temple was destroyed by the Romans. They were nursing that grudge for centuries. And once they had enough power, they said, okay, this is what we've been, let's go do it. You see, you know, Rome was the center of Christianity. Jerusalem was open to pilgrims. You could go to Jerusalem, and you know, it was okay if you wanted to take a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. So all the ostensible reasons why the Crusades happened, Flavio Barbiero talks about this in his book, don't really add up. They wanted it back because they considered that their heritage, their homeland. They wanted it, and they went and they got it. And all these nobles, you know, it was a big, expensive undertaking. They all went, and a lot of them lost their lives in this gigantic crusade. And that's where the Templars obviously come out of. And they, you know, they were looking for, maybe they thought there was some ancient wisdom, you know, still buried there, or maybe there's some stuff they wanted to get back. But the Templars is a really interesting, a really interesting question.
Let me ask you this quickly. What do you think about, I don't want to take this too much off topic either, but there's other things happening in Europe at this time. I mean, you brought up, for example, Charles Martel earlier, a lot of different brawls between the Franks and the Vikings, you know, Norse people and everything else. But at some points in this infighting, there were actually collaboration as well. There were, I mean, the Saracens, and there's a couple of things where they actually joined together to try to hold back the Muslim incursions in other parts of Europe at the time. It's very interesting in how the collaboration has gone, but how do you see the Islamic issue in this as well? Because it's also an offshoot of the covenant that Abraham set up with God there, and when he was 99 years old and nipped the tip of his of his own ding dong,
yeah,
as it were.
Right,
so
right.
So what is that all about? Is there any other deeper connection to that historical aspect of it with Islam and the Abrahamic, you know, religions overall?
Yeah, so that, well, I don't really get into that too much in the book. I would say that it's certainly a literalist tradition, but not entirely. You know, there's a mystical tradition in Islam too. You know, Sufis are more mystical. You know, I'm not an expert on that subject, Henrik.
No worries. No, I'm just asking.
Got some thoughts on that, but really, you know, the thrust of the book really is the history of the of what happened in Europe is certainly and the start of Islam and those same centuries that Charlemagne is and Charles Martel is going on in Europe. That's all. It's certainly tied in, but what I'm really looking at is this suppression of the shamanic, the suppression of the esoteric, by the literalist paradigm. That was basically, look, this is the only paradigm that you're allowed to have. And then once they stamped out all the esoteric or the Gnostic interpretations in Europe, then they started going around the world and doing it. They went over to the Americas, and the way that they treated, and you know, the genocides and the slaughters that took place in the Americas is, I think it's evidence that supports this interpretation of history.
Let me ask you about why it is. Do you think that they developed the facsimile in such a way that they did? That's it's another thing that I've been thinking about. Why not? I guess because it's a dual agenda here. And one way is about, okay, remove all of that, take it away, right? Of the old stuff, of the old traditions, of the old knowledge and wisdom and esoteric, you know, all of that. But then at the same time, the facsimile that comes in is still, after all of this, is still a preservation of it. Just as you mentioned before, some people, like Santos Bonacci's detail, like, well, wait a minute, look at this. It's the same astrological story weaved into it. It's the same. There's so many correlations between it. If this is a measure to control people, why not create a facsimile that is so utterly different and utterly disconnected and devoid even from this very aspect that people within the Bible might actually find a core truth, if you will, to what actually is going on in the heavenly realms, if I can put it that way. Why that?
That's an outstanding. You really get at some really good points here, Henrik, and I think that's a great, great point, because when they created Mithraism, they did the exact same thing. You can go into the Mithraic temples. Mithraism clearly uses a zodiac symbology. They've got the equinox symbology. They've got the signs of the zodiac, the slaying of the bull, the procession of the equinoxes. Christianity does the same thing. So why did they do that? Well, you know, so my book, you can enjoy and contemplate the history of it, whether or not you believe that any of this shamanic stuff is true or not, whether you believe, you know, that the ancient scriptures were really teaching the esoteric meanings that I say that I think that they were, whether or not you accept that personally as the truth, that's, you know, that's a separate question. But your question gets to that the question of, hey, maybe it really is true, because maybe there really is a connection between human beings, the microcosm, and the stars, the macrocosm. Maybe there really is a connection. You know, when you go into a university building, there are some that uses classical architecture, and you feel different based on the wavelengths and the vibrations of that building than you do in a modern architecture with a roof that's only 8 feet over your head and has, you know, the ceiling panels and artificial lighting. This stuff is real, you know, or at least that's a possible answer to your question.
Sure.
Why did they do that? Because they're still doing these rituals. They may be keeping the meaning or the, you know, secret, but look at all the cities in the New World, in the United States, that are laid out on specific parallels, that are laid out in specific ways, that have the patterns of the streets doing specific things. I mean, you've had people on your show that have spent a lot of time looking into this question.
Sure. Yeah.
Look at the rituals that go on. Look at maybe the people who know this stuff realize, you see, you know, there's evidence, and I talk about it in the book, that the ancients who had this sacred tradition knew that the universe, that we are made up of energy, that we're made up of waves, that we're made, you know, the Gorgons, what do they do? The Medusa, what does she do? She petrifies people into stone. She turns people to stone. We are like, we're the fiery spirit of spirit that's come down and plunged into the material, you know, that has been encased in a material. We've been given coats of skins like they have in the book of Genesis. We're like the stars. You know, this is another aspect of why they're using the celestial metaphor. The stars each day, they rise up from the, or apparently rise up from the eastern horizon, and then they arc through the ether up there. They're up in the world of fire and air, but then they hit the western horizon. They sink down into the ocean, the Pacific here in the West Coast, or they sink down into the hills. They sink down into the lower elements of water and dirt and earth, mud. That's what we are. We're like sparks, at least according to this esoteric system. The reason why all those cycles are important is it's like a it's like wax on, wax off. It's teaching you something about the human condition. We are this immaterial, ethereal, spiritual being that is now encased. We're going through the lower half. We're like the star when it's plowing through under the earth to get back to the eastern horizon. That's our condition. That's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're manipulating those waves. They know, look, we're made out of waves. We're really not made up completely of matter. That's what a near-death experience teaches you. You know, when we have this, these accounts of, you know, this woman had all the blood drained from her skull and, she, you know, she, her body temperature was lowered down to this. And then she said, you know, you were talking about this. And said, wait a minute, your EKG was flat. Your brain couldn't have heard that. You had stuff in your ears and we had it packed with gauze so that, you know, how did you know what we were wearing? I don't know. I floated out of my body and I saw it happen because we're not completely, that's what these things are teaching. We're not completely material. We're a combination. We're a spark that's plunged down into the material world. And that's exactly what all these myths represent. That's the incarnation in the New Testament. So they know that. And if, you know, you can say, well, I don't believe any of that. I don't believe in reincarnation. I don't believe in a spiritual component. Okay, that's fine. But that's what these, I would suggest, that's what these scriptures were teaching. Whether you accept it or not, I would argue that's what they're teaching. Even the Bible is teaching reincarnation, which I talk about that in the book and in the blog. And that's what these cycles represent. So if you can manipulate the physical realm, you can have impacts in that implicate realm, the seed realm, the realm of the duat, the realm of potentiality, the realm. Those two realms are interpenetrated. We were talking about this a little bit in the first hour, right? Where the Egyptian, you know, the Egyptians were going on these out-of-body experiences, according to Jeremy Nadler. And the, you know, the shaman goes to another realm in order to heal this child or in order to fix the problem that the village has. And by all accounts, they did heal and they did fix it. So you can make changes in that realm that impact here. You can make changes in this realm that impact there. And if you know how to do it, that's very powerful. So why did they keep this system? Why did they set up, even with the counterfeit, why did they keep the trappings of this system? Because they're using it. And by the way, they didn't let the scriptures into people's hands for centuries.
That's right,
you know,
exactly.
We're running around with Bibles in, you know, every hotel room. Hey, the Gideons put a Bible here.
That was not the case at the time, no.
You would have gotten killed if you had one in the days of, you know, Wycliffe when he was translating it into English. It was illegal to have one. Why? Because if you spend enough time reading the Bible, as I did, and you start to notice that it's, you know, maybe somebody clues you in, like Hamlet's Mill clued me in, that, hey, some of this may be celestial metaphor, just like the Greek myths are celestial metaphor. The more you look at it, the more you realize it's kind of dangerous to have those things in people's hands, because once you see it, it's obvious. So it was a death penalty to have the scriptures or to translate them into the vulgar languages of the common people for a long time. So they could get away with it. They could get away with it. You're saying, well, why would they do that? Well, because they could, and maybe because it works.
Well, exactly. I think there's two different aspects to it. One, maybe they didn't plan it to get out like that. I mean, it could literally be an effort to say, okay, let's just really distill, let's really take all of those things that we know, pour it into the scriptures in that regard, and then we'll eradicate it from the rest of the place. But we're still going to use something that's real that people are going to be attracted to. They have to recognize it. They have to resonate with them. You can't give them a facsimile. We see the same with manipulation today. It's just not 100% rat poison. You know, it's like you have to bring a lot of good stuff in there and then a little bit of the poison, you know, to kind of lure people in, right? And it could be the same thing here, because if they never planned that these scriptures would end up in the hands of people, all they got this from was from the pulpit, right? And from other people telling them what the case was. So it's kind of a, maybe it's a preservation act. Maybe it's like a, it's the arc of some of the knowledge that was there. Today, of course, it's a very different scenario and situations. We can't really compare it. We have so much material to, at our disposal today, although a lot of things has been lost. But nonetheless, kind of a scorched earth kind of strategy, right? You take what you have there, preserve it, and then you just wipe it off the rest of the face of the earth in order to manipulate and in order to gain control, you know?
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, it has to do with controlling large numbers of people is really hard to do, and it's hard to do it just with physical force.
It's never going to work.
Physical force doesn't work.
No.
Because, you know, in the hearts and the minds of the people, unless you get those under control, it doesn't work. You can't just use force. You know, the strategy of taking over the Roman Empire from the within, if that's what really happened, which I think it did, you know, by Josephus and the other members of these lineages, it wasn't mainly by force or even primarily by force. Force was like the last resort, or, you know, that was the fine tuning for the few things that squeaked out. But the main, you know, they took existing scriptures, these New Testament scriptures, they picked the, I think they picked the ones that when they declared, it was Athanasius, the Archbishop of Alexandria, in his first or his 39th festal letter, which was published in AD 367. So this is after Constantine, who said, hey, these are the 27 books we're going to use for the New Testament. I think they picked the ones that were, you know, the least, you know, there's other ones that they left out that show the Gnostic or the esoteric much more clearly, or, you know, those had to be suppressed or kicked out of the canon. They picked the ones that, but there's still enough evidence in the ones that they kept to see it, to see that this is really esoteric, this is really Gnostic.
Right.
That's what I would say. And I would say you're absolutely right in terms of controlling the people. You know, your metaphor was the, you can't just give straight poison. You got to, because people will say, this is an outrage.
Yeah,
this is, right. This is a violation. You know, and I think it's really important to bring in the concept of natural universal law. I think, you know, what is an ideology? You know, I think that everybody knows by the time they're, you know, 5 or 6 years old, hey, you don't do this. I mean, there's some psychopathic people who are wired in a different way. But in general, people will say, wait, that's wrong. That's why what Martin Luther King or what Gandhi was doing was so powerful, because nobody was paying attention to the outrages that they were putting up with, that they were enabling. But when Martin Luther King said, you know what, we're not going to fight back with violence. We're just going to do this that we have every human right to do. And then the police come out and start hitting them with batons. Everybody starts looking at that, and everybody wasn't paying attention before says, wait a minute, I didn't even care about this issue. But now I'm seeing something that is just wrong. That is just, that's an outrage. And that's how the nonviolent demonstrations of Martin Luther King changed people's minds, because he says, I have a natural law right to march up this street. Or Rosa Parks says, I have a natural law right to sit on this bus. And when the state deploys violence, then suddenly people say, wait a minute, I wasn't paying attention before, but now I am. So people naturally know, people naturally have within them, I think, a natural law as opposed to artificial law. Artificial law is like, hey, you can't, if you cross this line, you can't have this plant, but if you cross this line, you can. That's obviously artificial, but you can't just beat somebody over the head for getting a drink of water from this water fountain. Everybody knows that's wrong, but you can use an ideology to excuse, to get people to go along with doing horrendous things. You can, that's, in my mind, that's where the line is drawn of an ideology, the use of mind controls. And I got this from, actually, Mark Passio talks about this. I think you've had him on.
Oh,
before.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, he says, look, natural law, I call it natural universal law, but Lysander Spooner was a talked about good this. Stuff. You know, that's the key. An ideology gets people to look the other way to violations of natural law. And so you see, like, manifest destiny in this country. Hey, we have to drive those Native Americans off of those lands because it's progress. And, you know, it's manifest destiny. It's God's will. It's, we're bringing light to the benighted darkness. And people went along with it. They excused violations of natural law because they had bought into these ideologies, these mental constructs. And part of that was reinforced by this literalist religion. So,
yeah, initiation of force. That's that's what the state does. You know, that's what it has as it disposal. You know, in that regard, it's always about forcing another, will onto other people in that regard. And it's, and at the same time, then you realize when you look at history that that's a long time standing of human good old human traditions right there. You know, and that's just been a constant. I'd say through all our existence, we've had battles and fights and everything else longer than we haven't had it. And I think it's really something which is not, you're not going to be able to turn that page overnight. And in some cases, you might not have to turn that page overnight either. There's of course, aspects of simple survival mechanisms weaved into it. But certainly, of course, it's all about that step of initiation of force and beginning that process of doing something in that regard, which is upsetting the natural order of things. But I think you're right. I think people have that inherently in them. They know what things are, and then of course they're manipulated externally by ideologies, and those can run in either direction all the way over the place. But it's really interesting. I think there's a lot of history then in the book as well weaved into it. David, I wanted to ask you if there's anything else, kind of something big you'd like to mention and give out here before we begin to wrap things up, in terms of another topic or subject in the book that you bring out that you think would be interesting to people to know more about.
Yeah, well, I would just say that, and that last point that you just made, you made some really good points, and you talk about the use of force. So, hey, that's been around since before, whatever you're talking about in this book, the Constantine and the Josephus connection. Hey, weren't people using force before? Sure they were. It's, of course, that's a pattern that runs through human history. But when it's blatant, when it's, when it's hideous enough, people say, wait a minute, that's wrong. But by cloaking it in, the divine right of kings, this guy has a right to chop off your head because he's the king. That's what, it's always accompanied by mind control or by ideology. And I think, you say, well, we're not going to turn this page overnight, or you mentioned something like that. And I think that's right. But I like how you always, or often in your interviews, you want to end on a kind of an uplifting note. And I think what I'm trying to give here in this book, well, first of all, you have to know the situation if you want to change the situation.
Sure.
That's uplifting enough all by itself. It's like, we could talk about, you got to be able to see the prison that you're in so that you can walk out of it.
Yeah, that's
but true. Also, we can change it through, what this suggests is that the bad guys maybe are using techniques that aren't just force. But we all have access to, good vibes. Not that we're just going to sit around and think positive thoughts and everything will just suddenly become positive. Obviously, that's I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is, this is more than just a physical situation. And that's what these ancient texts suggest, and that's what quantum physics suggests. When you say, "Wait a minute, did that thing act like a particle or as a wave?" Well, it depends on if you looked at it. Oh, was that subatomic particle in box A or box B? Well, it was kind of potentially in both until you opened up the lid and looked inside. Really? That's weird. Yeah, it had to interact with a human consciousness. Whoa. You mean so there's and that, so the modern findings and the ancient scriptures are telling us the same thing, that this is more than a material situation. And that's a good thing, especially if the bad guys seem to have all the, they got all the bayonets and all the, things that can blow you up, but that's not all they've got. And that's not all that you've got. Because if that was all that you've got, then you're in trouble. But if there's a more than a physical component, that's a pathway of hope, or that's a door of, hey, there's a way to change this situation, and it has to do with pointing out when things are a violation of natural law and waking people up to the excuses that are being used. Well, wait a minute, you're using that excuse, but that's based on this this false narrative. Oh, you know, when you start to see that, I think it can start to make change. Just like we talked about at the beginning, I've changed a lot of opinions in my in between my writing of the first book and the writing of the second book. It's like the Truman Show, you know.
Yeah.
You start to see enough lights falling down from the stage lights falling down in the middle of the street, and the radio immediately rushes on and says, airplane had a little trouble. You know, they want to explain that anomalous evidence away, but eventually you see enough gaps and you can walk out of that dome if you want to. You can walk out of that prison.
Yeah. I mean,
if you want to.
God, there's a lot of those in history, by the way. My God, there is a lot of lies in what we've been taught and you know, the kind of information that's out there. And I mean, this is it's just an endless maze and quest in that regard of trying to figure this stuff out. But it's possible. And I think there are a lot of those key points that we can look at historically of, you know, both wars, but incentive for wars, or why did it turn out this way and stuff like that. And it's just that's something we have to continue to look into and try to get to the real answers of why the world is the way it is today. You know, my point here is never take anything for granted. Nothing at all. Everything you've heard about history, question that, examine it, question yourself why you're not allowed to question certain things about history. There are certain people in jail right now for questioning certain historical events. Why is that? Do you know everything about wartime, pre-wartime, post-wartime? Look into it.
And when they immediately, you know, when an artifact turns up in the Americas, and the voice on the radio immediately comes over and says, "Oh, that's a hoax." You know, it's like the voice in the Truman Show that's on the radio that's always trying to explain the anomalies. Yeah. When you start to see that over and over, it's like the hoax or the trick, the veneer is coming off, and that should be, you know, a lot of the guests that you have on, they're on here talking about it, and they're saying, well, it's frustrating because the universities seem to just not even consider this stuff, or they immediately classify it as a hoax. Well, that's a pretty good indication that that's what's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the Truman Show.
Yeah, you're not even allowed to look into certain things, or you're immediately, you know, excommunicated from the from the new church of believers, you know, if you question certain things, you know.
Right, but the good news is you can walk out of that dome.
Oh, you know, sure.
There's gonna be obstacles. There's gonna be, even your friends are gonna, you know, you see in that movie, the friends and family are putting obstacles in his way and saying, "Hey, Truman, you don't want to do that. You got a good here. You know, don't go out there." But you know, the obstacles that will be put in your way, you can walk out. So I'm just trying to end on kind of, you know, we got into some heavy topics there, but I would like to say that I think that this should be an uplifting message. This is, you know, this, I'm not saying we all have to become a shaman, but your mind can influence things. You know, if looking at a subatomic particle can determine which of those two boxes it ended up in, or whether it acts as a wave or a particle, or if, you know, giving someone a placebo can cause them to be healed, that shows that your mind can change matter somehow. So, you know, that's not shamanic, but it borders on that realm. You don't have to actually have to have an out of body experience, although the evidence seems to suggest that more people do than the conventional narrative lets on to tap into, or to get hope, or to examine this stuff further and say, hey.
All right. Very good, David. Give us the details about where to get the book, and of course, how people can follow your writing as well. I think you have a Facebook page up as well. So give us that.
Yeah, thanks. So the book is on Amazon. It's called The Undying Stars. The full title is The undying stars, the truth that unites the world's ancient wisdom, and the conspiracy to keep it from you. And that's on Amazon in both softback and hardback. And I will have copies with me at the Secret Space Program if you're going to that. And my website right now, I do have a website at davidmatheson.com, but that really points you over to the blog where I do most of my thinking. You know, in between writing my first book and my second book, a lot of these concepts are things that I worked out on the pages of the blog. So that's at mathesoncorollary.blogspot.com. You can see a lot of, it's fully searchable. You know, if you look in the upper left corner, you can search it. You can also translate it into all those different languages. There's a little button on the right-hand side where you can, if you want to read it in Portuguese, you can do that. I don't know how good the translation is. That's really where you can find what I do. And if you want to interact with me, you can send me a message on Twitter or on Facebook. I don't really have comments posted to the blog. It's not a place of interaction right now. I've been using Facebook to do that, although really I haven't really publicized it that much. So, but you're welcome to send me a message on Facebook and I'll try and respond. And, you know, some people do. I've had, you know, some great articles sent to me on Facebook and I've blogged about them. And, you know, I try and give credit, you know, whenever somebody stimulates a blog, you know, a line of investigation, and some of those lines of investigation have found their way into the Undying Star. So, you know, I appreciate your feedback on the book and, you know, check it out and let me know what you think.
All right. Very good. There we go. We have the links to both Facebook and Twitter right on the website there on the right-hand side. Scroll down there. We'll have all the links up on the website, of course, as well, so you can click through from ours easily. Well, thank you for coming on, David. Really appreciate it. Talking about your new book has been interesting. Looking forward to seeing you soon. So thanks again for coming on.
Thanks a lot, Henrik. It's been my pleasure.
Well, we're going to be back in just a few days. We have more coming with Felice Vinci and William Mullen, program you shouldn't miss, on the Baltic origins of the Homeric epic tales. Very interesting. We also have Dave McGowan, Gregory Sams, E. Michael Jones, and of course a return by Stephen McNallan, and many more coming on after this. By the way, I hope we'll get to see you in San Mateo at the end of next week, the weekend, the 28th and 29th. Of June for the Secret Space Program Conference. But if you can't make it and be there in person, check out the streaming tickets as well to catch the event live. SecretSpaceProgram.org is the website. All right, thanks for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your membership and keeping up with the important topics, exciting research, and of course, extraordinary realizations about our world, counter to the mainstream narrative that you won't be able to catch anywhere else than here on Red Ice Radio. Thank you for listening. Have a great day, and we'll talk soon.